Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash welcoming you to a special edition of Inside Track. As always, thanks so much for supporting our Inside Track sponsors, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. We have a great show for you today. Our first guest is U.S. Congressman Andy Biggs. We'll chat about the China tariff talks, Hong Kong gun control, and the Squad. National Review opinion writer William F. Buckley Fellow Madeline Kearns joins us for the remainder of our hour together. We'll talk about social scoring, safe zones, and very timely Brexit. Madeline Kearns is a bright and very insightful new voice on the conservative scene. So sit back, relax, and prepare to be informed with great political talk on Inside Track. Welcome to Inside Track. I'm pleased that Andy Biggs has taken time out to chat with us about what's going on in Congress and talking about the issues which are important to all of us. As you know, Andy Biggs is an Arizona native and currently serving in a second term in the U.S. House of Representatives, CD5. He resides in Gilbert, Arizona. Andy does have some great roots here at the University of Arizona after getting his law degree here. So he does have some Wildcat blood in him. And I've known Andy for many years and can attest that he is a true friend of liberty. We Arizonans are very fortunate to have a great GOP representation in Congress, and Andy is a champion for us all. Now, welcome to Inside Track. It's been a while since we've had a chance to chat together, Andy.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to it. You serve on the Judiciary Committee. Why are the dead-enders who run that committee still talking about impeachment?
Well, you know, Bruce, they really, this is visceral to them. They're emotionally connected to their hatred to Donald Trump. I mean, they still can't believe Hillary Clinton's not the president. And I know people will find that hard to believe because most of us just move on with life and deal with circumstances and try to make them better. But you have to remember, the day after he was elected, you know, Al Green from Texas said he wanted to impeach him before he had a day in office. And so they view this brief time, hopefully brief time, when they control the House of Representatives as an opportunity to impeach the president. And if they can't impeach him, they want to try to hurt him going into the 2020 election so he will have a real tough time getting reelected. You know, they are just connected to it, Bruce. It's irrational, quite frankly.
Does it help the president's reelect for this to continue on, or does it hurt?
I think it actually helps because I think it shows the radicalism of the Democrats. I mean, you've got them coming out with this, they want the government to control every aspect of your life. You and I would call it socialism, but I'm just trying to translate this for everybody. It is the government controlling every aspect of your life. And so they've gone that radical. And then this constant fixation with trying to impeach President Trump just shows that they're really kind of unhinged.
Let's go to something a little more positive then. I think you serve on a subcommittee in the House called the House Space and Science Subcommittee. Can you tell us the importance of the new Space Force that's been rolled out for us, Andy?
Yeah, so Space Force is really important because we're facing new kinds of cyber challenges, which include control of space. China has really tried to lay out and stake claim to the space efforts, which is going to include cybersecurity. So we've got actual physical territory in the space that China has really, they've actually in some places have exceeded us in their rocketry. And we have got to reclaim that superiority as a nation that is a peace-loving, democratically oriented nation like the United States. We need to have that as opposed to an authoritarian state like China, because we still need to maintain that stability, that balance of power in the world to allow the rest of the world to seek their own destiny. But that's why that's critical. And then the cybersecurity portion of that is also critical, because China, you know, we hear about Russia and their incursions into America's election in 2016, but I can tell you China was far worse then, and it's actually far worse now.
Yeah, my colleagues and I on the RNC refer to Russia as the little Satan. We refer to China as the big Satan. And whatever we thought was being cooked up by the Russians in 2016, we haven't heard anything yet about how bad it is coming up in 2020.
they really are an adversary, not just a competitor, but have probably become an adversary. But let me ask you, Andy, how did space become a battleground? I thought it was always supposed to be used for peaceful activities. So how do we and our allies defend ourselves in space? And are we, as well as our allies, willing to spend the money and the resources to make this happen? Or are we just having a space force in name only?
Well, number one, there's international space treaties, which is supposed to be exactly what you say. Make that basically an international competition free zone, right? So that's why you saw cooperatives between the U.S. and on some instances in space. But what's happening now is China, they want to be the hegemon of the world. They're a rising power. They view themselves as a potential dominant player, and they want to control space, and they view it as a potential place for weaponry as well as defensive systems. And that's really part of the problem, and they've acquired it through stealing technology and through developing new technology. And so we've got to be vigilant. And I think the allies and us are talking a real serious commitment to this. I believe that we're committed. I believe that the mission is committed to the Space Force and defending basically the right to peaceful use of space. We haven't seen an initiative like this president is doing in a long time. He wants us to get to Mars, laying the groundwork to get back to the moon. Then he won't be in office anymore, but then getting us to Mars. He's committed to that. We work on that committee all the time on these issues, and so I'm confident that the U.S. can reassert dominance in space.
Are we willing to spend the money? I mean, obviously, it's one thing to have a declaration. It's another thing altogether to actually allocate money for the Space Force. Or are we doing that? Is that part of the budget?
Yes, that is part of the budget. So funds have been allocated on both levels to reassert us in space, but also in the space defense, the Space Force.
Andy, I know part of your studies as a university student, both undergraduate as well as postgraduate, was on Asian affairs, and you certainly have become, through those studies and also your service in Congress, somewhat of an expert on East Asian, Northeast Asian security. China started a trade war against America and many of our major trading partners. Last week, the Trump administration trade advisor Andy Puzder told us on Inside Track that China needs a trade deal far worse than we do and is hurting with significant losses as a result of their intransigence on trade talks with us. You know, they've lost 5 million jobs. They're becoming our number three trade partner. They depend a lot more on us for trade than we do with them. Initiating crippling currency devaluation was a real major sign of weakness. What is your take on the president's trade policy with China? Are we on the right track or wrong track?
I think we're on the right track. It's long overdue. I mean, China, literally for 20 years, has basically had not a competitive advantage. We have ceded advantage over to China. They've stolen our intellectual property. They've attacked us in cybersecurity. They've had unfair and dumping issues going on with the United States. So they're not a great actor. They violated WTO rules. This is an authoritarian state. We tend to forget that. I mean, you know, they've got, don't forget the Uyghur problem they have, where they have over 1 million people in re-education camps in China today. And you see what's going on in Hong Kong. That's a direct result of their attempt to stifle freedom. So we're dealing with a state that is still, it is communist, and we forget that sometimes because we do so much trade with them. This is a president, I think, who has finally done what needed to happen probably 15 years ago, and he's standing up to China, and he's saying, you know what, we're not going to take it anymore. And we've been on this is the way I put it, Bruce, we've been on a suboptimal path for a long time, 2 decades at least, with China. And we've built up these regimes and institutions, and we've come to accept them, whether they're good or bad, but they're suboptimal, they're not good. And we're going to have to exit to a better path, a fairer path for our businesses and industry in trade with China. And it's going to cause some short-term pain, and it is causing short-term pain, and I'm not minimizing that. But I do believe the president's exactly right when he says the short-term pain is going to result in long-term benefits and a better trading relationship with China. And I'm behind his policies. I try to help the companies in our district and the state wherever we can, working with the trade office. But I will tell you, this is long overdue, and China does need a trade agreement with us.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome to Inside Track. I'm pleased that Andy Biggs has taken time out to chat with us about what's going on in Congress and talking about the issues which are important to all of us. As you know, Andy Biggs is an Arizona native and currently serving in a second term in the U.S. House of Representatives, CD5. He resides in Gilbert, Arizona. Andy, how do you assess congressional support from the Republican side and also from the Democrat side in the House with respect to the China trade talks?
Well, the Democrats have been fairly silent, and on the Republican side, unless you're from some of the Midwestern agricultural states, they've been very supportive. And even in some of those places, they've been very supportive of the president. The president has tried to ameliorate some of their concerns. I think that the new trade agreement with Japan opening up more of its markets to our agriculture is great. It's not a full offset, but it provides some relief. I think there's support there for the president. My own opinion is it's never as strong as it needs to be. I wish it was stronger. I wish we had actually more Republicans in Congress, and I wish we had more Republicans in Congress who supported the president on this trade effort that he's making.
And you make a good point. Japan is becoming a greater trade partner. And also, surprisingly, considering 70 years almost, where they were really in a self-defense mode, they've become more of a military ally to us as well, it seems.
So since World War II, in the Constitution, they could only maintain a small force relatively to defend their home islands. And for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is North Korea's aggression, they recognize the need, and we've been pressuring them really for 20 years to ramp up their military. I think they're going to change that article in the Constitution, keep the sense of what the article is about, but allow their government to expand their military, and that's a great thing.
Well, and really, they would still be acting within the terms of their constitutional construct, because really the potential threat they face from North Korea as well as China is a direct threat to the security and peace of the home islands there.
Well, I agree with that, but they've never interpreted it that way. But now that they see that there is a real, I mean, you're exactly right, when you perceive this real threat, when missiles are being lobbed over your islands from North Korea, you understand that's a real threat. They can reach us. They've got some theater missile defense systems in Japan, but they need to get more, and they need to have some offensive capabilities as well, because the technology that's available in warfare today means you can't just have a kingdom or an island where you can defend yourself. You have to be able to retaliate quickly. And I believe that that's where they're going. They're going to go to a next stage, which is an offensive response, a tactic. And that will, they'll have to try to, if they're not going to change the Constitution, they're going to have to try to couch that as part of self-defense.
So the situation in Hong Kong is at a crisis level. I had Dennis Kwok, who is a leader for the pro-freedom movement in Hong Kong, was our guest last week. China is punishing and threatening Taiwan. China's one country, two systems promise, which didn't come from outside, it came from Deng Xiaoping, his concept, is basically worthless. Why do you think it's important that we stand with the pro-freedom movement in Hong Kong? And maybe I don't mean to get you in trouble, but do you think that we should be fulfilling our past agreements to Taiwan to sell them the defensive weapons we promised and coordinate with flag officers in their defense forces, who aren't even able to meet with our military on any basis at all?
Yeah, so I'll take the second part first. I think we should be selling the defensive weapons to Taiwan. I think we should be cooperating with Taiwan. And I know that there was a ratcheting down of that because we didn't want to we had the trade agreements with China, right? I mean, that was, the notion was, well, we want to trade with China, we want to open those markets. But the reality is Taiwan has been a good friend to the United States of America, and China still has a one-China policy, and that's still present today. I mean, literally just read something yesterday coming out of leadership over there. They still believe that, and so we have to recognize that Taiwan is subject to this threat, and we need to sell them the weapons and cooperate with them, like we've had agreements in the past to do, as you say.
Yeah.
The Hong Kong issue is, I don't know if the world would have let this happen back in 97, but I sure wish we never would have given Hong Kong back to China. It's changed the trajectory of the entire world, quite frankly. But Hong Kong is fighting for self-determination in a system that is not designed to let them have self-determination, even though that was the original promise, that they would be able to have some form of self-determination in China. I mean, excuse me, in Hong Kong. I am amazed at how strong that movement is, and I am gratified by that. I will say that a lot of the enforcement mechanisms coming out of China right now, they're trying to disguise those. But they're, make no mistake, they're just as brutal as any authoritarian repressive regime is going to ever have. And that's what they're doing. They're just hiding them pretty well from the world and the media. It looks like you're paying attention. I'm trying to pay attention to that along with everything else. And I will just tell you that I don't know what the outcome of this is going to be or what it's going to look like. But I've seen China do a couple things that I never thought I would see when they had the extradition order that they put in place. I thought, oh, they'll never back off of that. And then you see this mobilization of massive freedom lovers. You go, wow, that is so cool. That's so great, you know? And they did back off. But we're a freer people. And China, I don't know that they're going to let them do that.
Let's move ahead to another topic, the fake news media's attribution to these various incidents being the president's fault in the aftermath of El Paso and in Dayton. The connection they're making to the president and white supremacy is really damaging finding real solution to gun violence, isn't it? I mean, this is just BS.
Right. It's Trump derangement syndrome. They're going to blame Donald Trump for everything, but, you know, no president was blamed for Sandy Hook. No president ever gets blamed for anything else, any of these other mass shootings. But here it's Donald Trump's fault. Why? I don't know why, because even in the manifesto from the El Paso shooter, when I read that, he specifically says, you know, I had these ideas before Donald Trump. I don't have any great love or affiliation with Donald Trump. It's absolutely paralyzing if you want to talk about of what issues might need to be corrected, not just in the gun and the violence sphere, Bruce, but in every sphere in Congress, because it's everything from immigration law. And I talked to some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who I think are more rational and who are willing to negotiate on this, or in a normal time would be willing to negotiate with me. They say, Andy, we can't afford to let Donald Trump have a political victory. They really believe that. And it moves on to the next step of getting back to what you and I were originally talking about. That's why they're so always consumed with this impeachment narrative. They just don't want a political win for Donald Trump, which means that they're putting their political feelings ahead of the what's best for the United States of America. I don't understand. If I thought they had a sincere belief in their policy position, I would say they've got a sincere belief. But they've told me to my face, we can't have Donald Trump have a victory. So whether it's a response to violence in the country or immigration or even on fiscal issues, it is always about hating Donald Trump all the time, 24/7.
The group known as the Squad in the House of Representatives, what are your impressions of what some say, and I think I agree some days, that these four women have become the de facto Democrat leaders in the U.S. House? What's your take on them? and their path to success at all?
Okay, so I'm with you. On some days, I think they have the carry of the day, and they manipulate Nancy Pelosi, and they do. Don't forget, if four votes swing differently, then Nancy Pelosi is not the Speaker of the House. And they came along and supported her and gave her the votes she needed. So they've got tremendous leverage over her. But at the same time, Nancy Pelosi, you know, for all of her flaws, she is a pretty clever politician as well. And she has managed to minimize them while letting them have massive amounts of reign and spin. The problem for Nancy Pelosi is you got a tiger by the tail. And these four are driving, quite frankly, the Democrat Party as far left, farther left than probably you and I ever thought possible in the United States of America. To hear the rhetoric, the open socialism, the advocacy for socialism, the open anti-Semitism by members of Congress, and the failure of the Democrats to step in and say, that is wrong, you cannot issue anti-Semitic statements, shows the weakness of Nancy Pelosi, but they haven't been able to consolidate power either. But there are probably a good 30, 40 members of their conference that adhere to what they want to do.
In the remaining time we have, I want to talk about an issue that is, I think, very near and dear to your heart and your work in the U.S. House, and that is your work on Veterans Affairs. What's on your plate to help our nation repay the debts to our veterans on health care, job services, and what is the status of your bipartisan oversight bill for the VA?
You know, Bruce, if there's a group of people you truly owe a debt to, it's to the veterans and their families who've made sacrifices on behalf of us. We get to enjoy the freedoms that we do in this country on a daily basis, constantly. And I'm grateful to them. So we work diligently trying to promote legislation that's going to benefit them. But there's so many problems. For instance, the Phoenix VA. I think they're trying, but you know, we're still a 1-star rated facility, and that's not good enough. That's not good enough for them. So we have a bipartisan bill that I put together for greater oversight of the Phoenix VA so we can get a real sense of what's going on, where the flaws are, so we can correct it. And every U.S. senator, both our senators, every member of the delegation, both Republican and Democrat, have signed on. And for all these many months, I've been trying to get the Democrat chairman of the Veterans Service Committee, Congressman Takano, to hear the bill, and the chairman won't hear it. And I have been relentless. Every time I see him, you know, we hear the bill. It's bipartisan. Will you give us a hearing? Will you give us something? It is critical. And we're asking for the same thing that they do in Florida, in the Miami area, because they basically have more oversight. The Congress is the congressional office can actually have house their office in there one day a week, so that every day there's different members, both Republican and Democrat. They'll have their office down there. So what they can do is they can meet with constituents down there. They can help them go through the morass within the Veterans Administration to get the benefits that they earned and deserved and have been promised. We're working on this, and it's just probably as simple as it comes and as straightforward as it comes, but we can't get it through Congress. We can't even get a hearing through the Democrat-controlled Veterans Services Committee.
Well, that's too bad for us and our veterans. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I hope you'll agree to come on the show a little more often. All of us south of the Gila, we're under enemy occupation. You're actually our lifelink, and when we do come back, I'm hoping we can touch base again on the Veterans Oversight Bill, as well as your ideas to restructure the Ninth Circuit Court. But yes. Until then, thanks for appearing with us today, Andy, and all of our listeners, stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for the remainder of the show today is Madeline Kearns,
from Glasgow, Scotland. She's a William F. Buckley Jr. Fellow in Political Journalism at National Review. Madeline was awarded vocal scholarships by the University of St. Andrews, graduating summa cum laude in 2015. She taught high school English in one of the most deprived constituencies in the UK, then won competitive scholarships to study in the US. As a 2017 summer intern at The Spectator, Britain's best-selling political magazine, she wrote a cover story detailing her experience at New York University, which became one of the most read stories that year. She graduated from NYU with her master's degree in 2018. Her second cover story for The Spectator in October 2018 was about gender policies as they relate to young people, a topic she now covers extensively for the National Review. And I also need to say, Madeline is a trained classical singer. Perhaps she'll sing for us later today, but we're we're happy to have you on the show. Welcome to Inside Track. I've wanted to travel to Scotland for my entire life, but more importantly, how do you enjoy living in America?
I love America. I've really fell in love with America, and I don't sort of overlook all the obvious problems, but every place has problems. No person's perfect. No place is perfect. So I really enjoy it. I have a great time here.
Madeline, in America, so many performers, will kind of talk about your fellow performers. Taylor Swift and Deborah Messing come to mind for some of the bile they blurted out recently. They mainly come from the left. How do your fellow vocal performers react to a conservative amongst their midst? And from Scotland, your native home is not known for being a bastion of conservatism. How do your friends back home react to your political leanings?
Such a great question. Well, to be honest with you, I really came to political consciousness slightly late. So my first degree was in English literature, but I was studying music and I had the scholarship that you mentioned. And so everybody I was associating with was like really very far left. And I really worked out that I was conservative, or that I was on the right, by working out what I wasn't. So I spent first 4 years of my undergrad sort of thinking, I'm not sure about that, when my friends would put forward their political opinions. And now I notice a real difference. So the friends that I made during that first degree, they now just kind of humour me and my terrible extreme viewpoints, as they think. I always like to point out it's only extreme from where they're standing, but in any case, they sort of think, oh, well, you know, Maddie's a bit eccentric, she's a bit different, and they kind of humour it. But in America, I've found it actually just the state of polarization in the country, that it's quite difficult to be friends with people who have very different politics. And that's not something I'm used to, because I don't see why that has to be the case. You know, I would understand that maybe it's not a good idea to like marry someone who has like completely different politics or something. But I quite enjoy, you know, having discussions, having disagreements, as long as it's respectful. But yeah, in America, I've struggled with that, to be perfectly honest.
So I'm sure you were aware in the 1960s there was a political movement going on at about the same time as the anti-war movement here on American university campuses, known as the free speech movement. How in the world did we get to the point where liberals in the 1960s are now where they're trying to control free speech on college campuses, do you think?
Fantastic question again. Well, I think about this a lot in terms of what William F. Buckley was writing with his first book, which he wrote when he was 24, The God and Man at Yale. And his argument in this book, which conservatives often forget now, was that there's no such thing as academic freedom, because what people really mean when they talk about academic freedom is the freedom to promote their own viewpoints. Now, this was a very controversial argument at the time, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, so I'll just quickly explain that what he was saying by that wasn't that we shouldn't allow people to be able to express themselves or to be able to teach things that they want to teach. But what he was saying is that we need to be transparent. So we need to do away with the pretense of neutrality. And we need to say, and he, in his case, he was talking about Yale. He was saying, we need to say, this is a Christian university committed to the free market. And so if you want to teach communism, if you want to teach atheism, you're going to have to go somewhere else and set up your own uni. That's what he was saying. And he said, well, because it's a Trojan horse, like all this academic freedom stuff is a Trojan horse. There's a great irony now, of, as you know, as you just mentioned, which is that now the positions have flipped. So you have the left fiercely guarding their orthodoxy, with the pretense of neutrality, of course, of, you know, pretending that oh yes, we're all about we're all very open and tolerant and so on and so forth. It doesn't extend to viewpoints, but never mind. And you have conservatives kind of speaking in the same sort of language as people on the left were in the 60s, as you mentioned. And so there is this kind of very strange role reversal that's going on. I like to differentiate between, I think, free speech, which I would believe in a sort of absolute sort of First Amendment principle, and then the right and proclivities of various private institutions to decide who they hire and so on. But I think what really does grind my gears is just the level of hypocrisy that goes on. I think actually if a lot of these colleges were just to say, well, listen, here we're going to teach extreme radical leftist ideology and extreme radical views about gender and so on and so forth, I think a lot of parents might think twice before shelling out their $30,000 a year or whatever it is and sending their kids to such places. Yeah, so, but it's all a bit of a mess now, I'm afraid.
Well, $30,000 a year would be a bargain compared to some schools where it's probably closer to $60,000 or $70,000. Let's talk specifically about Amherst College. They developed a common language guide, they called it. What was their purpose behind the guide?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I really could not make sense of it. It was a document that came out of their Office of Diversity and Inclusion, which, I mean, tells you everything you need to know right there. And I think that the document was soon after disassociated from the by the office because it caused so much backlash. But it was described by its authors as a list of carefully researched and thoughtfully discussed definitions for key diversity and inclusion terms. And so it came up with sort of a glossary of wokeness, if you will, things like Eurocentrism, heterosexism, ethnosexism, cissexism, and then all the normal ones like transphobia and ageism and so on and so forth. And I mean, I wrote about this for National Review, as you know, and I just think it's utterly deranged.
So you know, I'm probably somebody that you could hate because I'm 67 years old. You know, I would be defined under ageism sort of things. And I really don't care. I mean, I've never cared, you know, being a Jewish American. I never really cared if people didn't like me because I was Jewish or because I was a businessman and I made money. I mean, why are people so damn sensitive today on every single thing? There are so many things we can't talk about in polite company anymore.
Well, I think it's partly the way we've been raised. And then in colleges, it's the way that students are radicalized by primarily administrators, actually. I mean, I said before that you can tell a lot from the term Office of Diversity and Inclusion. What good is an Office of Diversity and Inclusion doing, really, other than sort of radicalizing students and teaching them to seek out offense in every corner? I mean, I was raised kind of, I guess, now it's perhaps a little traditionally, I had three brothers and I was brought up in Glasgow to believe that sticks and stones could break my bones, but words couldn't really hurt me. And I'm really glad that's how I grew up, because, I mean, it's just, you just can't really go through life being such a sensitive person, or you're just going to be very miserable and not get very much done, I would have thought.
Before we go to the break, which is coming up pretty fast, the guide defined critical race theory as a theoretical framework that critically examines the intersections of race, power, and the law, and condemned the view, admittedly naive, especially given the content of the document, that society has moved beyond radicalized barriers. It describes such views as deadly post-racial ideology capable of causing racial battle fatigue, which can result in high blood pressure, anxiety, frustration, shock, anger, and depression. Sticks and stones can break our bones. I mean, but gee whiz. I mean, Have we become such a soft society that words hurt more than sticks and stones?
I guess so. I mean, but this is something that the radical left has always done, which is to conflate language with sort of objective reality. They think that by changing language, you can change reality, and by using the wrong language, you are effectively committing acts of violence and so on and so forth. It's just so silly. And I've written so much about this stuff now that I kind of got exhausted by it. That's all I have to say, really. It's just so silly.
All right, well, that's a good place to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the other things that Maddie has written about. You're listening to Inside Track. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hey, let's change topics just a little bit. We're here with Maddie Kearns. Earlier in the week, you tweeted, quote, little pigs, let no deal Brexit in, not by the hairs of our chinny chin chins. Well, then we'll huff and we'll puff and we'll blow this house in. What could possibly go wrong? Against good stuff, Madeline. As a Scottish native, what is your take on the current fight in Parliament, and who's going to win the argument?
Well, first thing to clear up front is I do not have a crystal ball, and I really wish I did, because it's just at a point right now where really anything could happen. But here's what I think is happening at the moment. So first of all, just to get the facts, yesterday Johnson lost a vote which allowed MPs to take back control of the parliamentary process, and that means that they will now put forward a bill which Parliament will vote on whether or not they can block no deal and extend the Brexit process even further. Now, important piece of context is that the Parliament is overwhelmingly against a no deal eventuality, against a no deal Brexit. In fact, I think, to be perfectly honest, Parliament is overwhelmingly against Brexit, period. And so what Johnson has devised is a very, very confrontational style of government. And I am quite sympathetic to his approach, because we have just been going on and on and round in circles for the last 3 years. And he came in and said, no, like, we are not going to compromise. This deal that the EU have put forward is unacceptable. Parliament's already decided it's unacceptable. Unless they change and they remove these unreasonable demands, then we should leave without a deal, and we're in a position to do that. We're prepared for that. Theresa May used to say at the outset, no deal is better than a bad deal. Johnson still believes that. But the difficulty now is that I think what's likely to happen is that if Parliament loses confidence in the government, Johnson's only real option is to call for a general election, an early general election. And the difficulty here, I mean, there's many, many potential things that could happen and go wrong, but the difficulty here is that if Parliament passes a bill to block no deal Brexit before a general election is held, then the Conservative Party under Johnson will be going into a general election knowing full well that they can't deliver on the single most important promise that they've made, which is that we will leave by October 31st. That's a big, big problem. So, I don't have a crystal ball, but it's a very, very tense situation right now, and it's only going to get more tense in the next week. But in the next few weeks, actually. And, I've said from the outset about Johnson that this premiership is high risk, high reward. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
So, Madeline, I assume you're still a British subject at this time?
I am, yes.
Yeah. So, as a British subject, how do you feel as a citizen of Scotland? How do you feel about the EU dictating laws that affect you in your hometown, in your home country, and things that they impose upon Brits that really restrict and restrain their freedoms?
Well, I feel that it's unacceptable. I think there's a democratic deficit, and that much has been clear for years, actually. I mean, it's not like, I think especially in Scotland, where we have a very big like fishing industry, and we have agriculture and all these things that the EU sort of has all this red tape. Now, there is one thing I'll be perfectly upfront and say I think is maybe a little bit of a contradiction in my position, which is that I'm against Scottish independence, that is, independence from England, not because of philosophical reasons. I'm very, very sympathetic to the idea of sovereignty and the argument for sovereignty, but I'm against it for practical, pragmatic reasons. So I just think that the current government couldn't pull it off. They're a mess. They're very far left. Our economy would do really badly, and so on and so forth. But I do think there's a little bit of a contradiction in that I am pro-independence for overlooking and overriding the argument for sovereignty, but I am pro-Brexit because of primarily reasons to do with sovereignty. So I'm, even though there's economic uncertainty, I'm willing to sort of risk a bit more if we're still tied to London. So the dynamics of it get very, very complicated very quickly. But yes, I actually forgot what your original question was.
Well, I guess, Madeline, the issue is, I think Americans and Brits, are cut from the same cloth. We don't like people from other countries telling us what to do. And the EU has become this big, bloated, bureaucratic, regulatory sort of blob that wants to tell British subjects how they're going to walk, where they're going to walk, when they're going to walk, and the direction that they should go. And at some point in time, and I think the Brexit vote showed it, even though it was relatively close, I think the British public are saying, no, we don't want to do that. And there's no reason why we can't have this relationship, these economic relationships, but we're tired of you telling us what to do. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Absolutely. I mean, that was a huge, huge part of it. I mean, there were other issues as well, as I know you know, to do with sort of immigration and things like that. But I think the Leave campaign just made a really compelling case for you know, their slogan was "Take back control," right? And that was a powerful slogan that resonated with people. So absolutely, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
So as we kind of conclude here today, I want to get your take on this. Jeremy Corbyn, who in the world would trust this guy? And this guy is an anti-Semite. His party is filled with anti-Semites. They would tax people to death. They would ruin business. They would regulate the heck out of British citizens. Why would anybody trust Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party today?
Well, I really don't know who and why. Well, I mean, I do know who and why, but it's insane. It's insanity. I mean, it was funny. A senior colleague was telling me yesterday, he's like, I think that Johnson's greatest sort of insurance policy is actually Corbyn because he is so unelectable. Now, there's a demographic, especially people sort of my age, university educated, middle class, who are really, really into identity politics. They're really into sort of anti-Jewish conspiracy theories and all sorts of really ugly, ugly things. And they're a big force of support for Corbyn. That people call them Corbynistas. But I think for most kind of people in the middle and so on, they just think, oof. I mean, first of all, this guy's actually a bit sick. I mean, His biographer spoke to his ex-wife, and she said that he had, in 4 years of marriage, he hadn't read a single book. He left school with really bad grades, and fair enough, like, you know, not everybody does well at school, and they're late bloomers, but he came from a good background, and is really just not a very bright guy, who doesn't really have any ideas about how we're going to get out of the Brexit mess anyway, and he's just completely single-minded on his creating his socialist utopia. So to answer the question, I mean, my hope is that the British people are too smart to be taken in by somebody like that, and so I'm quite hopeful, you know, I could be eating my words here, but I'm quite hopeful that he wouldn't get the keys to 10 Downing Street. I have to be hopeful about that.
Well, Maddie, that's going to do it for today's interview and today's show. And I hope we can have you back on the show. There's lots of stuff we didn't get to. And I know you're going to continue writing on these issues of culture and so on. So please take my call when it comes. Friends, I hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast, our visits with Madeline Kearns from National Review. and Congressman Andy Biggs, please support our great sponsors, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Corazon Cabinets, and Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Until next week, for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.